I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking today with Andrew Petto. He's a professor of biology, a lecturer in biology at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And he is the editor of the reports of the National Center for Science Education in Oakland, California. And we're talking today about a book that he's just edited again called Scientists Confront Creationism, Intelligent Design, and Beyond with his co-editor, Lori Godfrey. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you.
And this book first came out in 1983. Now, back in 1983, was there intelligent design or was it just creationism?
No, there was just something called creation science. That was the current terminology. Intelligent design actually came about just about the same time as the Supreme Court decision in 1982 that made it clear that religiously based creationism could not be used in the schools, in the public schools, as an alternative to science. There was a little book that had come out at that point, which began the idea that life was intelligently designed, and the phrase first came out in about 1984. The first textbook that was proposed, textbook supplement that was proposed that would use it as a scientific theory was the book of Pandas and People, the central issue of biological origins. That came out in 1989 in its first edition and in 1993 in its second. But what was interesting is during the Kitzmiller trial in Dover, the early drafts of that book, Pandas, we'll call it for short, the early drafts of Pandas were found, and the words creationism had been globally deleted and replaced by intelligent design. Other than that, there were no changes at all in the text, except the change in the terminology. So the pedigree of intelligent design is really in the creation science area, and the idea was to try to find a way to make these ideas that there was some kind of divine intervention in nature, in life, as a part of the science curriculum.
Just, I guess, to play devil's advocate with the, I mean, I clearly am a person, a secular person who believes in evolution, but I sometimes think that the case conflating intelligent design and creationism is overstated in that it seems like the intelligent design people have conceded an awful lot of ground that the creation science folks, like this Creation Museum in Tennessee, are still trying to validate the flood and, you know, to go with a 6,000-year history of the planet. And it seems like intelligent design is a far more constricted argument than that.
Well, they have what they call the big tent strategy. And the strategy there, as first articulated by Philip Johnson, who is the lawyer in Berkeley who was one of the spearheads, who's sometimes known as the godfather of intelligent design, he said that we first need to split science from its naturalistic roots and allow for a more theistic view of life, and we can argue about the details later. And so, therefore, you'll find people embracing intelligent design who really literally believe in a 6,000-year-old Earth, and you will find people in the intelligent design camp that are really quite comfortable with a universe that's several billion years old, and you'll find everything in between. So it's one of those things that has, let me take a step back. If you ask any scientist how old the Earth is, they will tell you unequivocally about 4.5 billion years. You ask somebody in intelligent design, and they'll say, well, we don't have a definite answer for that.
Because because their statistical argument... Okay, let's backtrack again to what the intelligent design argument is. As I understand it, there's two basic intelligent design arguments. One is that the statistical unlikelihood of evolutionary processes suggests that there's probably a designer instead of random chance. And second, a cosmological argument, which I want to get to later, which is not the subject of your book, but a cosmological argument that our universe is statistically unlikely. So given the argument from statistical unlikelihood of genetic processes, you're saying that they would raise doubts about the billion-year ancestry of the Earth because if evolution was ginned up somehow by an intelligent designer, then the whole thing could have been ginned up somehow.
Yeah, you see, there's a fundamental problem in the approach. I think you have framed the argument correctly, which is that there is a high unlikelihood of these things. It's so unlikely that it is pretty close to impossible with some kind of intervention. But it depends upon a really interesting trick. And the trick is that it brings to the fore the argument about biological randomness. So in biology, when we talk about randomness, we mean that there is no set direction. In mathematics, when you talk about randomness, you say that every option is equally possible. And the mathematical randomness is something that William Dembski, who's the mathematical mind behind all of these models of intelligent design, he uses the mathematical view, whereas biologists do not. So that's the first thing, is that we're not saying everything is equally likely. In fact, evolution is decidedly non-random. Mutation at the level of DNA is also non-random. It is random in the sense that we can't predict the way it will go, but we know certain kinds of substitutions in DNA are much more likely to occur than others. Certain kinds of change in protein molecules are much more likely to happen than others, and that has a lot to do with the ways that these things happen in biochemical models and in real living systems. And so those things are really important to keep in mind. So if it were simply a matter of mathematics, then these guys would be correct in one sense, that there's a very, very, very low probability. But it doesn't seem to bother people that we have an extremely low probability for winning the Powerball. And yet millions and millions and millions of people go out there every day and try to do it. So being very, very, very rare or very, very low probability does not mean that something is impossible. The second thing is that critics like Michael Behe are assuming that every protein in the body is made brick by brick, as it were, by taking one piece and adding the next piece and adding the next piece. And one of the things we know about biological chemicals is that the various things that the body uses are modular. There are little pieces that are built together. So it's kind of like a Lego set, you know. They go together in certain ways, but there are lots of different ways that you can create a structure using them, and you can create many, many different structures using the same modules. And so the idea that we have to start out with one amino acid and then add the second one to it and then add the third one to it and the fourth one and so on until we get a protein is really a straw man argument. It's just not the way that that biology works. So the argument is that that random mutation and natural selection are insufficient to account for all the complexity and diversity of life. That's the statement that the Discovery Institute has on its website. And most biologists that I know would look at that statement and say, well, duh, no one is saying that. You know, no one is saying that just random mutation and natural selection account for all the complexity and variation in life. They are important processes. They are fundamental to our understanding of the way that life exists on Earth and how it changes on Earth. But that's not all there is to it, and we know that that's not all there is to it. They're also fond of saying Darwinian. They're also adding Darwinian evolution, you know, and Darwinian change and so on and so forth. And, you know, Charles Darwin died in 1882. He hasn't written much lately. There's a lot about modern evolutionary theory that Darwin could not have imagined. He could not have understood. That depends on discoveries in biology and in chemistry and in physics that we have made in the 100-and-some years since Darwin died. And so these have all added to our understanding of the way in which things work. So partly the critics of evolution under the rubric, the big tent of intelligent design, are sort of playing on this scientific illiteracy, the fact that we, unfortunately, do not teach evolution in public schools the way that we ought to, the way that we understand it in modern terms. We talk a lot about Darwin. We talk a lot about Mendel. We talk about a lot of, you know, dead white guys who were doing their research in the 1900s, when there's a lot of really interesting stuff that's been going on in the last 20 or 30 years. Part of the problem is what's happened in the last 20 or 30 years is still starting to sink in. We're still trying to figure out what a lot of that means. But we could do a much, much better job of what goes on in secondary school, which is where most people get their science. And a lot of that could be done better by those of us in the universities who teach the people who are going to be the science teachers. You know, so we really, you know, we've met the enemy and he is us, as they said in the Pogo comic so many years ago. We need to be sure that people understand evolution in the modern way, in the way that we understand the process is going on in terms of 21st century biology and 21st century chemistry and 21st century physics.
This is Change Shifter Radio. I'm Dr. J. We're speaking today with Andrew Peto. He's the editor of Scientists Confront Creationism, Intelligent Design, and Beyond, which is out with a new edition and in the paperback, which is it's coming out in paperback this month. Andrew, you mentioned that Darwin hasn't he wasn't able to incorporate a lot of contemporary scientific advances into the theory of natural selection as he developed it. One of the really interesting things, and you also mentioned bricks, the building bricks and the modular approach that we're beginning to understand about genetics. One of the connections here is that students are learning how to genetically program with modular genetics. This BioBricks approach apparently is revolutionizing genetic education. I know it's a bit of a tangent, but I thought it was totally cool. I read recently about a bunch of biology students who had come together for just a couple weeks and were able to use these modular tools to build entirely novel organisms. And that seems to validate somehow this notion that evolutionary process could have been modular as well.
Right, and what we see a lot of is taking existing structures and modifying their use. I mean, the main argument that Michael Behe has against evolution is that when you take a structure that is well suited to a function and you modify that structure, even if you're moving on the way toward another function, you have this point at which it's not very good at what it used to do and it's not very good at what it's going to do. And this has been a conundrum for developmental biology, for evolutionary biology for some time. But in the 1970s, when I was in graduate school, this was a problem that was proposed as a problem with evolution as regards things like how do you get a fin and turn it into a leg, or how do you get a leg and turn it into a wing, and so on and so forth. And at that time, we thought that the answer was in developmental biology, but we didn't have the technique, the technology for being able to study that. Well, during the 1980s and 1990s, those techniques and technology were developed, and it turns out, by gosh, we were right that it was developmental biology, and you could do a lot with some very, very simple changes in the genome and produce whole suites of changes in the living organism. And so what's happened is that the arguments against evolution have retreated to the molecular level. And it is true that at the molecular level, we don't have some of those answers yet, but we're beginning to see some of them. One of the most dramatic ones that I think I've seen came out probably about 5 years ago now, studying the problem that we have as critters that came out of the ocean that looked like insects, take those little brine shrimp, and came onto the earth. Well, those things that live in the water tend to have legs that go all the way down their bellies, and the ones that live on the earth only have legs on what we call the thorax, and the abdominal part of it is completely absent, has any legs on it at all, has no legs on it at all. Well, one of the things that we try to figure out is how could that happen, and scientists noticed that there was a very interesting difference at the end of one of the chromosomes, that there was a sequence of DNA that was repeated many, many more times in the six-legged insects compared to the 10-legged crustaceans. And so they did some experiments, and they duplicated those genes and stuck them into the embryos of crustaceans, and guess what? They ended up with legs only on the thorax and not on the abdomen. A really simple genetic change, and one that we know occurs naturally, because that's essentially the same thing that happens in humans and the thing that we know as fragile X syndrome. It's a sequence of DNA at the end of the X chromosome that's repeated a certain number of times, and the more times it's repeated, the more serious the effects are on the boys that are affected by this, and it causes systemic changes, that is, changes throughout the body in multiple systems.
Andrew, part of this argument seems to be that we're beginning to understand the hierarchical nature of the genome. And I saw just last week that the number of genes that are estimated in the human genome has been knocked down to 20,000 from 25 or what it was before. And people used to estimate like 150,000 genes, and now it's only 20,000. But the reason that we get all the complexity of a human being out of 20,000 genes is because they are hierarchically controlled in that modular way that you're talking about.
That's right. It's clear, clearer now than it ever was, that this is a question of interaction. And it's a few basic components that gets reused and recombined in different ways. Now, this shouldn't surprise us, because we all learned in high school that there are only 20 amino acids. And those 20 amino acids make all of these different proteins that we have. And so the structure, as we think about it, is just all the way down to the level of the DNA, there are a few very, very simple things that produce amazingly complex results by just being combined in different ways.
This debate about intelligent design and creationism is it's impossible to separate it from the debate about secularism and belief in God in general. And your book is coming out in the wake of many books about atheism, the new atheism jihad, as some have called it. I know that those, the biology professors and science educators want to separate those two issues. Do you think that they're separable? Can you really make a full-fledged argument on behalf of a naturalistic explanation of the universe without being a part of the atheist jihad?
Well, I think that's an ongoing issue. I mean, that is the elephant in the room. And when you tell people, as you often see the contrast in some polls that we see, that you can believe in God or you can accept evolution, it's the Pascal's wager. There may or may not be a God, but do I want to take the chance of eternal damnation? And there was an interesting series of books that have come out, authored in part by Chuck Colson, and one of them is called A Christian Perspective on Science and Evolution. I would argue that none of that title is applicable to what's in the book, but basically the issue that gets raised in that book is, if you teach your kids evolution, they're going to go to hell. That is a serious concern that people have, and we can't really overlook that. That's an important part of the discussion. On the other hand, at the National Center for Science Education, on our website, we have official statements by, I can't remember the number now, but at least 19 official statements by religious denominations telling us why they have no problem with evolution. We have an annual event now called An Evolution Weekend, in which various clergy around the country have agreed to use their Sunday school time, their adult education time, their sermon time to talk about issues of religion and natural science. There are many organizations. One of them is at Berkeley, the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences. One's in Philadelphia called the Meta-Nexus Institute. The American Association for the Advancement of Science has a dialogue on science and religion. There's a lot of active engagement about this. The one thing that we don't see, and I think is probably not what we should be doing, is to say this particular scientific idea supports this particular theological idea. At the very least, we know that the Earth is not 6 to 10,000 years old. We know that the flood of Noah probably was a regional disaster that occurred because of a natural dam that broke in the Black Sea and really did inundate huge, vast expanses of what today we would call the Middle East, caused lots of death and lots of devastation in that area. But there's no evidence geologically of a flood that covered the earth for a year. You know, so we have to be careful about what it is that we look at in terms of, you know, religious ideas and their implications for us today. And the other thing I would argue, as I often do, is that if somebody says something is true by faith, then the scientific argument really is irrelevant to it. And people who are trying to support religious ideas through scientific ideas are, you know, probably making a big mistake. There's a lot that we could look at, you know, in terms of, you know, prescriptions for diet, prescriptions for health, how you treat diseases in various scriptures, that today even people who say they absolutely believe in those scriptures wouldn't do. And probably the most famous is, you know, what you're supposed to do if you have leprosy, as the Bible tells you very specific what you do if you have leprosy. But most people, even people that say they believe in the Bible literally, instead would go to a doctor and get an antibiotic because it's a bacterial infection, you know. So, I mean, we have that issue going on there. The other issue is whether you know, science is atheistic. Well, so biology is atheistic in the sense that geometry is. You know, I mean, we don't rely on divine intervention to give us the Pythagorean theorem. It's just the way that triangle sides combine and the ratios that they have to each other. And that's what we're looking at in biology or physics or chemistry. We're looking at the way that the world works. And there are a number of evangelicals out there who are actually pro-science and say, you know, understanding properly the way the world works is essential to their fulfilling their perceived mission of Christian stewardship in the world. So there are multiple views on this, but there are a few Christian denominations for whom the findings of modern science, and not just in biology, but in other aspects as well, they find do not fit with their notions of when and how the universe was created and how it's run. And that's really the issue. You can't get away from that. No, one approach to it is the one that you mentioned, is simply saying, you know, you guys are all silly and this, you know, there's no need for God in any of this. And the other one is to say, let's look at what we're saying and what you're saying and figure out where there is a real conflict and where there really isn't. And anybody who's going to insist for religious reasons that the earth is 6,000 years old is not going to be comfortable in modern science. People who say that, you know, there's some ultimate force in the universe that organizes it may or may not be comfortable with modern science. We're seeing a lot going on in physics today. But, yeah, we are redefining the science that ancient peoples had, the way they viewed science, in a way that is not perhaps compatible with the way that people would have written about the way that the world works 10,000 years ago or 15,000 years ago, or when those scriptures and those myths were first put together.
Andrew, it sounds like it's a wonderful book, and I'm looking forward to the paperback edition of it coming out. We're talking about Scientists Confront Creationism, Intelligent Design, and Beyond. The hardback came out last year. The paperback comes out this month. Thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
And now for a primer on intelligent design from Smart Bomb Radio.
American Educational Film Strips presents Intelligent Design.
This is Billy.
Hello.
Billy is curious about evolution.
I sure am.
Of course you are, Billy. Let's ask this scientist all about evolution.
Well, simply put, the scientific theory of evolution...
You shut your filthy mouth, scientist.
But he was gonna...
Don't worry, Billy. I'll explain. Evolutionists, or godless crackpots as we like to call them, believe that 6,000 years ago, two monkeys fell in love. They engaged in out-of-wedlock monkey intercourse, which is sinful,
Actually, you're way off base with that.
Hey, I didn't interrupt you when you were talking.
Well, you kind of did, and now you're...
Someone who's going to burn in hell for his blood?
What?
Exactly. So instantly, in one generation, these monkeys had a baby. And that baby was you, Billy.
I'm part monkey?
Of course you're not, Billy. But that's what these crazy scientists want you to believe.
Well, that's not exactly what Darwin said.
Shh! I'm so confused, Mr. Narrator. I don't want to be a monkey, but I love science.
Well, Billy, there's another group of people who loved science. They were called the Nazis.
Now that's just not right. You can't just...
Actually, the Nazis used Darwin's theory of evolution as the basis for all of their Superman experiments. So in a way, evolution is fascism. You're not a fascist, are you, Billy?
I don't want to be a Nazi.
Of course you're not, Billy. You're a God-fearing American. You love football and partial nudity on the TV.
Okay, this is just stupid. I'm leaving.
Well, you've got me convinced, but what can someone like me do to stop evolution?
That's easy, Billy. First off, stop evolving. Every time you let your genes mutate, you're offending God.
And what else?
Next, you've got to stop science. Think really hard, Billy, using all of your parochial school education.
I've got it! Operator, give me the FBI. I found a terrorist.
Brilliant, Billy. Your vicious slander will surely stop him from corrupting any more children with the powers of deductive reasoning.
Hello?
Sir, you need to come with us for questioning.
What's this all about? I haven't done anything wrong. I'm a teacher. Here, let me get my wallet out and I'll show you my ID.
He's got a gun!
Oh, stop resisting! Stop resisting!
Stop resisting,
I'm not resisting, I'm shot!
Oh, crap. Put a knife in his hand.
I just... wanted to teach science to young boys.
Great job, Billy. But don't get too excited. Your hands will go right to your genitals. And that's where Beelzebub lives. So another pinko ends up where he should be and science marches on. Free of science. So remember, kids, if evolution were true, I'd have a self-lubricating hand.
That was Smart Bomb Radio, which you can find at smartbombradio.com. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Our opening and closing music was composed and recorded by Ricardo Campa. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.